supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. When we are in pain, well, when we're in acute pain, the sensation, of course, is unpleasant, and we expect it to end eventually. We do whatever we can. We mobilize our body, our systems, to find out what caused the pain and to fix it. But a headache, for example, that lasts more than a day can be exhausting. Back pain that won't go away can begin to have an impact on our lives. And when acute pain becomes chronic pain, often it's the pain that becomes the problem and not the problem that caused the pain. And that's the case for 10% of all Americans. And the number climbs as we age. So on today's show, we're going to take a look at chronic pain, what it does to us, how it affects our bodies, how it affects our minds, and how it affects our lifestyles. And there's lots of good news in the area of chronic pain. And we'll hear about that good news from my guests, Dr. Sarah Whitman and Paul Christo. Whitman is a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Drexel University. She's also got a private practice specializing in chronic pain. She hosts the website howtocopewithpain.org. Dr. Paul Christo is the Multidisciplinary Pain Fellowship Director for the Pain Treatment Center at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And Sarah, welcome to you to the
show.
Thanks for joining us. And we want to hear from you. If you've got chronic pain or a loved one has chronic pain, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Paul, let's start with you. Why are so many people in chronic pain?
Well, I think that a large number of people have suffered from chronic pain for a long time. It's just that over the last several years, there has been an increase in our awareness that chronic pain can be treated, and there has been an increase in our knowledge of how to treat chronic pain through research. So I don't know that it's that we've had an increasing number of people who now complain of chronic pain, rather than I think that it's just due to awareness and education. More people admit that they have been suffering from chronic pain.
Interesting. Sarah, I'd like to hear you weigh in as a psychiatrist. Not so much about whether the numbers are increasing or not, but the American Psychological Association just came out with a study that we're under, that the level of stress we live with is up 50% over the last 5 years. And I wonder about living with chronic stress. Does that increase our risk for pain, and does chronic stress make pain worse?
Well, pain certainly is made worse by chronic stress or any stress, and just having pain itself is a significant stress for many people. In addition to what Dr. Christo said, one of the big pushes in medicine is to recognize pain. This past decade has been the decade of recognizing pain and trying to increase treatment for pain. Pain has actually been made one of the vital signs that people look at on hospital wards. Blood pressure, pulse, breathing, and now pain level is assessed.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's new.
Right.
Sarah, you have a personal reason for getting involved in this field. It happened in your psychiatric residency, yes?
A little bit later, about 7 years ago. So 10 years into my psychiatry practice, I developed a chronic and sort of unusual chronic pain condition called RSD, also called reflex sympathetic dystrophy, a pain condition that has severe pain. Mine was luckily on the milder form and has improved, which some people don't get that, unfortunately.
Say more about those two words, severe pain. Help us understand that level of pain, those of us who just know the pain from a headache or something like that. Tell us.
One of the things I talk with patients about is most people experience a headache, or some people, you know, experienced a broken bone and know what that level of pain is. And in the introduction, you said, you know, most people expect pain to decrease and get better, and doctors can do something about it. For many pain conditions, that's unfortunately not the case. And some people live with mild chronic pain, a low back injury, some arthritis that is there but not really significantly affecting their lives. Many of the patients that I deal with have instead moderate to severe chronic pain that lasts. If you can imagine the worst headache you've ever had and having that day in or day out. One experiment that I'll do with when I do talks about pain is have people put their hands in ice water for 15 seconds. Most people at the end of 15 seconds can't stand it anymore, want to get their hand out of that. And I say, can you imagine having that level of discomfort all the time, 24 hours a day? And you can sort of start to see how pain can affect your life, affect your mood, not be able to work, all the consequences that come with severe pain.
Paul, how do you assess pain? I mean, traditionally, doctors ask what the number is from 1 to 10. Is that the assessment?
That's part of the assessment. So when we see patients in a clinic situation, we do the usual history and physical evaluation and then focus on their pain, and we do ask them to rate their pain, typically from 0 to 10, 10 representing the worst pain imaginable, and, you know, 0 representing no pain at all. And further, though, we do ask them to describe their pain and how it's impacted their life in terms of waxing and waning factors, what makes the pain worse, what makes it better, what medications, what other treatments have they used to help reduce the pain. We ask them also to use a pain diagram and to, on the diagram, show us specifically where they suffer from pain.
Tell us, Paul, how that helps you. What do you do with that information?
Well, it gives us a global picture of how pain has impacted their life. And often we're seeing patients who have been seen elsewhere, for example, by primary care physicians, and other treatments have been incorporated and usually have not been very successful. So once we gather even more specific information, a more complete picture, it really enables us to better come up with a treatment plan.
I'm curious about what options there are out there. I mean, traditionally we start with medication. That's the first. Let me turn to you, Sarah. Is that the first treatment, is medication, when somebody comes with chronic pain?
I think pain sometimes is a different sort of problem than many of the problems people are used to. If you come into your doctor's office with high blood pressure, usually you start with one medication. They may talk with you about, you know, exercise, eating right. You go home and it improves. Same thing with asthma. Chronic pain is often different than that, in the sense of, in the very beginning, it's very helpful to take a wide-ranging approach to treatment, looking at medications, possibly procedures, and then in addition to that, all the psychological support and techniques people can use to both cope and try to decrease their pain. One of the things I talk with patients about is it's often not one medication that's going to get you from a pain level of 10 down to 0 or even 5.
Well, and then the big questions that I want to talk about is, there's a certain amount that we're going to have to live with. We really mm-hmm. have to change our thinking about pain and what mm-hmm. it means. We've got to, when it goes from acute to chronic, we have to think about what we will live with and maybe give up the idea that mm-hmm. it'll go away, that we'll have yesterday back. We're talking about chronic pain, what its implications are. So many people are living with it, how they're living with it, and what treatment options are. I'm with Paul Christo, who's with Johns Hopkins. He runs he's the Pain Fellowship Director there. And Sarah Whitman, who's a clinical assistant professor at the Department of Psychiatry at Drexel. Let's take a phone call. We've got Alicia on the line. Alicia?
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Dr. Gottlieb.
Hi.
I have had chronic pain for about 13 years, and initially I was on narcotics. Oh, let me tell you what I have. I've got cervical radiculopathy and fibromyalgia and a bum hip. And initially it was very devastating, the pain, and I moped and I complained until I just developed an attitude that just came with experimentation. And number one is when people ask how I'm doing, I always say great. I don't want to complain to other people. That just puts the focus back on my pain. And secondly, people don't want to hear it.
Well, let me stop you there.
Sure.
There's a lot of ways of saying I'm great.
Mm-hmm.
You can say it with clenched teeth, or you can say it with an open heart. You can say it. You can say I'm great with an invisible finger in the air too.
I say it with a great big smile.
What's going on inside? Do you mean it? Is it heartfelt?
Oh no, I mean it, and I mean when I take the focus off of my physical being, and I put it on how my life is. And that's what I mean by doing great. I've got a great husband. I've got a good job. My left leg hasn't fallen off. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So
the pain has become a part of your life rather than the thing in your life.
Yes, and it took me a long time to get there. And now I think of it as an annoying sensation rather than something that I have to constantly mourn or grieve or make it important. I've made it less important in my life.
Go ahead.
One way of doing that is number one, to keep active in the community, see friends, talk. Boy, that's a big diversion. When I talk to people, my pain level goes down to practically zero. I volunteer. I'm a mediator for the courts. The big thing is keep moving. I always say if I snooze, I lose because I tighten up and I hurt worse.
The question I have for you and the final question I have is how do you get from there to here? You have a wonderful attitude. The pain you see in context, I'm sure that's not how you felt when it started. How do you get from there to here?
Well, one of the most important things that I said about not complaining is I was complaining to somebody and on a regular basis, and they just said, boy, you are so negative, and all you do is complain. And I would have been taken aback, but I took that constructive criticism, and I said, well, let me try that. And I found that the less I complained, the less of a focus I put on my pain.
Good for you and good for your friend. You know, in AA, there's an expression, fake it till you make it.
And, it's taken years.
Yeah.
It's not a quick fix.
Well, I really do appreciate your call, and I appreciate your wisdom that you have shared with us and everybody listening to the show.
You're very welcome.
Wish you the best. Thank you.
Thank you.
Paul, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh says that smiling releases endorphins, and that the more you smile, the happier you actually feel. I'd like you to comment on how one gets from A to B. Is there a process of mourning? How do you make that transition from acute pain to chronic?
Well, your caller represents a sort of a true success story, I think, and this reflects someone who's conquered pain and not allowed pain to conquer her. And what I try to impart upon those who see me who suffer from pain is not to allow themselves to disengage from the world and from society. And I see that a lot, time and time again, in patients who suffer from chronic pain. And I encourage them to seek out the services of healthcare professionals, psychiatric healthcare professionals, psychological healthcare professionals, to give them the tools to remain, you know, focused and engaged and part of life.
But physiologically, Paul, when we are in pain, I would imagine that our defenses mobilize and demand us to focus on our pain and focus on ourselves and get small and withdraw and kind of narrow our lens. I would think that's adaptive with acute pain.
Right. It is with acute pain. And acute pain is often easier to treat because it's we often know the cause of the pain. For example, a surgical procedure or an arm fracture. And the pain may not be extremely intense. It usually requires short-acting, you know, medications over maybe a couple of weeks or maybe a couple of months. So acute pain is often easier to deal with for physicians and then also for the patients because there's an end in sight.
Right, right.
Whereas with chronic pain, there really doesn't seem to be an end in sight, although I do believe that there are effective treatments that can mobilize together to help patients who are suffering from chronic pain to live a more controlled and a more reasonable life.
I want to get to some of them after our break, but before we take a break, Sarah, I want you to comment on one aspect of what she talked about, and that's the relational aspect of what to do, what does chronic pain do for and to intimate relationships?
Chronic pain, I talk about not just affecting, it's not just the pain that you have to deal with, and it's not just you yourself that have to deal with it, but it really sort of ripples on the pond of your whole life. It affects your family in the house with you, it affects friends, it certainly affects work. The caller talked about a couple helpful ways, you know, with distancing or distraction from the pain. But the idea of moving towards acceptance of, you know, I'm not going to get my old life back, I'm going to get as close as possible, but I do need to make adjustments, that is a process, and it's a very difficult process.
It's painful and it's long.
And sometimes people get stuck at different places. Sometimes it's the most challenging thing that somebody has dealt with. I guess also you don't want to overemphasize that you are just your pain, but nor do you want to forget this process. It's really a growth process for a lot of people, and one of the most important struggles and challenges, and sometimes from struggles and challenges, we get some good growth as well.
In a weird way, hopelessness is helpful here.
Hopefully people don't get quite to the bottom.
Well, here's what I mean, though, about hopelessness. Mm-hmm. Giving up hope that you'll have what you had yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that contributes to pain, yes, when you try to clutch mm-hmm. under the belief that you will have yesterday again.
That you're going to be pain-free, that your body is going to be okay.
That's what I mean about yep. hopelessness.
And it is loss. It's sort of not wanting to switch from focusing in the past. I used to right. have this to how am I going to move forward? I'm going to have chronic pain, but how am I going to have the best life that I can?
I'll tell you an interesting insight I had about chronic pain. You know, I've got a spinal cord injury, and I've got what's called nerve root pain in one of my arms. And it's extremely severe. And I noticed for the first 6 months or so, that was a major problem, maybe even a year. That was a major problem, and I was medicating it, and I wasn't tolerating it, and I was in agony, and I was focusing on it. And then all of a sudden, I realized that pain is not a symptom that there's anything wrong, that I don't have to do anything about the pain, and I stopped being so reactive to it, that it is simply pain. I mean, it's not pleasant, mm-hmm. but it is simply pain. And some mm-hmm. days it's worse, some days it's not. But it's not a call to action. It is an experience that happens to be pretty unpleasant.
And that's many of the chronic pain conditions. Pain is not a symptom of a problem, but it's a disorder in the pain systems of our body. So you're right. It's nothing that we have to get rid of or it means something terrible is happening. It's just a feeling and
chronic,
you can go on.
Chronic pain, like chronic illness, like chronic disability, mm-hmm. is chronic, mm-hmm. and we find a way to live with it. Well, no surprise, all of our lines lit up as soon as I gave out the phone number, and it really does speak to how many people are in chronic pain. That's what we're talking about on today's show. We're talking about chronic pain, who lives with it, what the implications are for families, what it does to our bodies, and most important, what can be done about it. My guests are Sarah Whitman, who's an assistant clinical professor at the Department of Psychiatry at Drexel, and she hosts the website howtocopewithpain.org. Paul Christo is a multidisciplinary fellowship director of the Pain Treatment Center at Johns Hopkins University, and he joins me by phone. Our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
With Philadelphia's murder rates on the rise, WHYY invites you to take a look at what communities can do to reduce violence. In the Spirit of Family presents The Universal Language of Grief, an evening with three mothers who've lost sons to violence. Moderated by Dan Gottlieb, this free event takes place on November 29th at 6 p.m. here at WHYY, made possible by the Jewish Family and Children's Service of Greater Philadelphia. To RSVP, please visit our website at whyy.org.
In the early 1950s, Edward R. Murrow hosted a program where Americans could speak from their hearts.
This I Believe. By that name, we bring you a new series of radio broadcasts presenting the personal philosophies of thoughtful men and women in all walks of life.
I'm Jay Allison. Join me as we explore the remarkable history of This I Believe, from its birth during the Cold War to its revival on NPR today.
Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about chronic pain today, what it is, how it happens, most important, what we can do about it. My guests are Paul Christo. He's from Johns Hopkins University. He runs the Pain Treatment Center there. Sarah Whitman is a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at Drexel, and she hosts the website howtocopewithpain.org. That's one word, by the way. I'm curious about what pain does to the body. Sarah, you're specifically interested in what it does to the brain.
Well, they're connected.
Yeah, I would think. That's the allegation.
What the thing that I look at mostly is, as a physician, I take a look if somebody's receiving correct medical treatment, and then moving beyond that, taking a look at what techniques I can offer and teach somebody to both try to decrease their pain through psychological ways, and also coming to what we were talking about, coming to that acceptance of this is their life and how are they going to make the best of it with having chronic pain in their life.
It's very difficult. You're asking someone who's got severe pain to A, not only learn how to live with some of it, but B, now go see a psychiatrist or a psychologist, implying that there's something wrong with your mind, and or you are weak and or a hypochondriac. Nah, I'm not going to be a happy camper if somebody's suggesting that. So how do they get to you and with what kind of attitude?
In general, psychiatry, if a primary care doctor, a physician, or somebody else suggests, you got to go see a psychiatrist, there's a lot of hesitation. In my experience, most of the people with chronic pain are looking for anything that will help, and there's a lot less resistance to seeing me. I also call myself a pain management psychiatrist rather than a, it's in your head. One of the first things that I do is talk with people about just because you got a referral to me does not mean that your doctor thinks it's just emotional, that you're faking this or you're exaggerating this. And I talk about that most people with moderate to severe chronic pain should have some psychological support. And there's many skills that I can teach to help decrease pain.
I want to get to those skills. I'm curious about something. Paul, what's your discipline?
Primary discipline is anesthesiology, and then my subspecialty is pain medicine.
Okay, so we've got a psychiatrist with a subspecialty in pain medicine, and an anesthesiologist with a subspecialty. Why is that? Why two different disciplines? Is that traditional? Are there other disciplines that get involved? How's all that work, Paul?
Well, there is no specific training right out of medical school for the sort of specialty of pain medicine yet. Right now it's that you train in another discipline. Typically it may be anesthesiology or psychiatry or neurology, for example, and then you spend additional time training after that in pain medicine, the interventions and the medications, special medicines that are used to treat that population of individuals. So there is, it's a fairly new discipline, and that's why there is sort of some disjunction between specialists who treat patients who have pain.
And who were you? You run the pain treatment center.
I do.
At Hopkins. Who works there?
Well, we have anesthesiologists who are specialists in pain who work there. We have psychologists who have specialty interests in pain. We have nurses who, again, have specialty interests in pain medicine who work there.
I see. And do you have a similar program, Sarah, at Trexel?
No, we. There was talk for a while about doing a multidisciplinary, because that's the best way we do know to treat pain, a multidisciplinary clinic, but we were not able to do that at Drexel.
Why?
I think Drexel had some different goals not related to pain medicine. Because there's so many people that do pain, it's also an issue of what department is going to get credit for the program. And it's expensive to treat pain correctly. Even though you get the best result, it's easier to say, well, just use medications, that's it. Trying to get insurance reimbursement for some of the things that I do, or putting together a good pain program, is very expensive, and not everybody wants to pay in the short run to get long-term benefit.
So let's follow that lead, because what you just said begs the question, what is the ideal way to treat pain, and why is it expensive?
Pain is a very complex symptom. Some of the underlying disorders that create pain are complex. And if you think about having, you know, on one pain team, an anesthesiologist like Dr. Christo possibly doing narcotic medication or procedures that help block some of the pain signals, and then a psychiatrist that takes a look at, is there depression? Is there anxiety? Teaching relaxation skills, guided imagery. It's not one visit twice a year. Sometimes I see people for weekly for 12 weeks or 6 months. And then looking at physical therapy.
Gotcha. Let's go back to the lines. We've got lots of people who've been waiting patiently. We've got David on the line. David, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Gottlieb. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been listening to the show, and your first caller, who I subscribe to her positive outlook, and basically have tried to live my life like her. I've been a chronic pain sufferer for 9 years now due to a sports injury. And although I try and do exactly what she said as far as positive attitude, when it comes down to it, I'm just really fooling myself. And
what do you mean, David?
I'm certainly at my wit's end. I have always been a very active, positive person. And through my 9-year pain ordeal, I have tried to keep that attitude, although it's the only thing that really keeps me going, keeps me functioning through my day, is telling myself that even though I have chronic pain, it's not me, it's just something that's there. But
it sounds like all this self-talk is not doing the job.
Oh, no. When it comes down to it, most days it's very hard to just get out of bed and go. I've been told that, you know, that I've seen the best doctors around this area, and I've had some surgery and lots of different therapies, but the pain still persists.
Are you depressed?
Absolutely. I am certainly depressed about being a chronic pain sufferer. However, if you would ask my coworkers, people that know me just on a peripheral level, they would never think I am depressed.
Only. Yeah. I mean, what makes this situation so much worse is pain is invisible. I mean, it doesn't scream. My situation, I sit in a wheelchair, and, you know, that's not subtle. You know, people see it and respond to it, and yours is invisible. So that changes your peers' expectations. Don't go anywhere, David. First, I want to hear Sarah's reaction.
Okay.
You know, in listening to these two callers that have called in so far, I want to be really careful about not, if you're not in this great shape and accepted the pain and moving forward, that it's, you know, something your weakness, or that you, well, you just haven't worked hard enough to accept your situation. That chronic pain, I think, is one of the most difficult things to deal with. Again, for many people, it's the life challenge. It's the hardest thing that they've dealt with. And there's the pain, which is uncomfortable, and then there's the consequences of pain, losing relationships, not being able to work, for David, not being able to do the sports that you've loved. So I want to be careful that saying, you know, it is a process and it's difficult. And if you're a little farther on the path, but not at the end of the path in terms of, you know, I can deal with this, continue to work on it, but don't blame yourself for not being farther along on the path.
On David's behalf, let me be tough on you and you, Paul. My God, it's 9 years. Mm-hmm. You know, who do I blame? Can I blame doctors? And if I can't blame doctors, can I blame myself? I mean, 9 years is a long time. How long is this path? Paul, let me turn to you. I'm fighting for you here, David.
Thank you. Well, I think it's important not to blame anyone, not to blame himself, not to blame physicians, nurses, the healthcare system, because I just I don't feel like, in talking to a large number of patients who suffer from pain, that actually helps them get any better, frankly. And what I think Dr. Whitman had mentioned earlier does. For example, you know, when patients come to me and are depressed and anxious and isolated and wonder where else to turn, I often encourage them to see specialists like Dr. Whitman, because what I think I've learned actually from patients who have benefited from the mind-body therapies, for example, is that they do help, and that it helps patients realize that, well, okay, maybe they can't return to their previous level of function or their previous activities, but what they do find are new ways to enjoy life and to participate in life that may be different from the past, but yet are still there and exist. I think that's critical.
Yeah, I do too. David, let me ask you two questions.
Go ahead.
What is it you want? What are your goals?
I want to be able to have a thought process free of the constant nagging reminder that it hurts.
I see. So what you'd like is a shift in attitude?
No, my outward attitude is great. It's just that the physical pain is there, and it's a reality, and it hurts. And I've gone through every modality and been on and off all the medications and done the mind-body work. And
when you say, wait a minute, when you say you've done the mind-body work, what have you done?
I was treated by a pain management psychologist who, you know, that was his specialty, who basically released me after going to him once or twice a month for about a year. There was nothing else he could offer me. We did some types of hypnotherapy and relaxation techniques, but...
Do you still practice them?
Yes, absolutely.
Are they helpful?
They are helpful for the moments that I do them, but when moments throughout my day, when my stress level goes up, my pain increases, or my pain, I notice my pain increasing, which increases my stress level, and then
sure,
I can't concentrate.
Sure. Sarah, reactions. He went to see a psychologist for a while and tried mind-body work. Is that it?
I mean, if David came into my office, I would look and see what sort of comprehensive, again, like one thing is not going to do it, but comprehensive treatment. There may have been advances also from the last time he saw, I don't know what the injury was, but be the last time he saw somebody that dealt medically with the pain. Then I would take a look at how severe are the depression and anxiety symptoms, and can those be treated both with therapy, possibly medication. Some of the medications that we use as antidepressants also help, even if you're not depressed, help with pain levels. And then it's, you know, it's the challenge of working with somebody to, even if the pain is there, how can you make the best life possible? Getting the pain down to 5 is different than a 7 or 8.
I would also imagine that chronic pain is similar to obesity and many other chronic problems. It really requires a lifestyle change. And I'm not talking about catering to the pain, but I'm talking about a lifestyle change so that if meditation works, then one might need to be more devoted to meditation, to do it daily or several times a day, or take some time off during the day to do it in the middle of a pain episode. But instead of becoming a chronic pain person, to become a meditator or things like that. But
I talk with people about they may be walking around with this 200-pound block on their back, and they're not going to be able to do the things possibly that they used to do. But focusing on getting as much as possible this weight off their back so that they can do things that are positive. And it may be, you know, with fibromyalgia, for example, you have to take periodic breaks through the day. That's a loss that you can't be your usual busy self, but taking care of yourself in the midst of this difficult situation is the first step, and nothing else is going to come after that.
David, I hope the call was helpful. I hope you got some helpful information. Sarah Whitman is with the Department of Psychiatry at Drexel. Wouldn't hurt to give her a call.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks so much for your call. Before we take a break, Sarah, I want you to address the relationship between pain and depression. I know a lot of people, for example, for people who have chronic insomnia, offer either pain medication relatively permanently or an antidepressant permanently, and it's almost like they're saying it almost doesn't matter. Do they both live in the same place in the brain?
They live in the same place. Often they come together. With depression, people often have more physical complaints. With pain, a chronic pain condition, depression often comes, especially in those initial stages of not liking what's happening and not getting very far very fast with getting better. Many of the medications that we use, antidepressants, again, work both for the depression and the pain. The thing I would say about them living together is even if somebody has chronic pain, antidepressants can help. But I don't want to imply also that, well, if you have chronic pain, you should be depressed. That may be an initial stage, but it should not be always accompanying each other.
How often do they? I would think they accompany each other the vast majority of the time.
About a third to half the patients have depression during pain episodes.
Paul, we have to take a break, but now that we're talking about medication, when we come back, I want to talk about narcotics, which is a common treatment of choice, and doctor and patient fear of becoming addicted. I know you've got a lot of thoughts and data on that topic, so I'd like to revisit that when we come back from our break, okay?
Okay.
And that was Paul Christo. He runs the Multidisciplinary Pain Fellowship Program at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. And Dr. Sarah Whitman's a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Drexel. She's also got a private practice. And her website is howtocopewithpain.org. And that's what we're talking about, chronic pain, what it is, what we can do with it, and how it affects our families. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2. 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
Meet the new neighbors.
I thought they were quite charming.
How do you feel about them now?
Less charmed.
Davis, California's newest residents are tough.
That can be a little intimidating.
They're trouble.
These three will see a bike and give chase.
They're turkeys?
When birds go bad.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about chronic pain on today's show with Sarah Whitman and Paul Christo. Whitman's a clinical assistant professor at the Department of Psychiatry at Drexel. Christo is the Multidisciplinary Pain Fellowship Director for the Pain Treatment Center at Hopkins School of Medicine. Paul, I want to talk about this business of narcotics. I know a lot of people are afraid to take them, and a lot of doctors are afraid to prescribe them. Where do you weigh in on that?
Well, I think that the use of opioids or narcotics can be essential in treating patients with chronic pain, certainly with chronic cancer pain and also with chronic non-cancer pain. It's been more difficult for physicians to understand how to treat patients and feel comfortable treating patients with opioids who have non-cancer-related pain. And part of that relates to the abuse liability associated with using opioids, and that is that they're controlled substances by the Drug Enforcement Agency. So the non-medical use of prescription opioids has been increasing substantially over the last 10 years or so. And those, for example, certain agents like hydrocodone and oxycodone are among the most commonly diverted and abused. So it's understandable that physicians who are prescribing these medications are worried.
Well, we've got two different things going on here. And you are talking about really two almost distinct different things, both of which sit inside the physician's head. I mean, one is the fact that these drugs are diverted a lot and can be abused. But the other is you're sitting with patient X who is in pain. You know what I mean? They're two different things.
Absolutely, and therein lies the struggle. So
Often
we are engaging other medical therapies before we use opioids. And, as Dr. Whitman touched upon earlier, in many instances, it's a combined approach of a couple of different medications, one of which may include opioids.
Are opioids your last choice?
Well, they're often one of the last choices. In other words, I think they are essential. They can be extremely helpful, but because of the liability associated with using them, and actually because of sometimes the difficulty that patients have in understanding their use, I typically reserve them later on in therapy if some of the procedures, some of the injections, some of the other medicines fail to provide adequate relief.
What other medicines? What do you mean by injections?
Sure. So some of the other medicines can include over-the-counter medicines like anti-inflammatory, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications like Motrin. And then progressing from there, we incorporate certain antidepressants that can be quite useful in treating what's called neuropathic pain, as well as anti-epileptic medications that have been found to be useful in seizure disorders and yet through well-designed studies have been found to be useful in certain pain states. And then there are certain procedures that also can be quite helpful for certain types of pain. For example, for low back pain or for shooting arm pain or shooting leg pain, certain injections, nerve injections, can be useful in helping to reduce pain.
Okay. I'd be interested in hearing you weigh in on this, Sarah. One thing I do know about pain is if it starts off severe, the important thing is to get on it right away and don't try to tough it out, which is our instinct, especially those of us who are blessed and cursed with testosterone.
One of the things that we used to think was that chronic pain only started to happen after 3 months or 6 months if you had pain that continued. We now know that some of the changes in the spinal cord and brain that sort of perpetuate pain happen within days of significant pain. I guess a couple of the issues about opioids or narcotics, they're not so effective. I mean, they can be helpful, but it's not the balance of, the risk of addiction versus 100% relief of pain. Many people get only a small percentage decrease in their pain, and they're not wonderful medications in the answer, unfortunately.
I'm surprised.
I think there's also some issues of what the definitions are of addiction or being dependent on narcotics. Addiction is really poor use of medication, using more than you're supposed to, getting it on the street, going to multiple doctors, using it for other things, getting high instead of using it for pain. Most people that use narcotics do not do that. So the concern of, they're going to get addicted, only about 5% of the people that are using narcotics for pain get truly addicted. You usually get into it. It's a disease of addiction.
And I would think that the people who are worried about getting addicted are the ones who are not likely to get addicted.
There's certainly, if you've had an addiction in the past or you have very few other coping skills, then the risk of using using narcotics inappropriately is higher.
I want to follow up with something you said just briefly, and then I want to get back to callers. You said with acute pain, something happens in the brain that turns it to chronic, that something about the brain that holds on to the pain even when the problem goes away. Explain.
Basically, if you have an injury in your hand, let's say, it travels up your arm into your spinal cord, into your brain, and registers as pain. As soon as those processes happen, for some people, even if your hand heals, the pain signals are sort of get stuck in your brain. I give people an example of there's a little gerbil on a wheel that goes around in your brain, and at some point, for some people, even if the original injury is healed, the brain can't get off that pain track. The gerbil can't get off on that wheel. And we used to think, again, that happened way down the road with chronic pain, with pain. But we now know that some of those processes happen quite quickly. And you're right, that interest in treating pain aggressively so it doesn't create those changes.
Are you telling me this whole show ultimately is about how to treat the gerbil?
Yes. It's a veterinary show. Obviously, preventing chronic pain is much better than trying to treat it. So right. If we can prevent that, sometimes we can't, but we're moving. I also think that we're at the beginning of how to treat chronic pain. We're just really identifying how to measure it, what are some of the basic processes. So we are at the beginning of understanding pain.
My joke and your answer, I think, is only a half a joke about treating the gerbil. Let's go back to the phone. We've got John on the line. John, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Gottlieb. How are you?
I'm okay. Thank
okay.
you.
Hi, Dr. Whitman, Dr. Christo.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Dr. Whitman, I think you're definitely moving in the right direction, and I'll be on your website as soon as I can. I'm really glad that you all are talking about this topic today. I know this has been a topic on the show before. I would like to make a quick observation, then a suggestion. I am a chronic pain sufferer. I have chronic nerve root pain and neuropathic pain from an accident. I worked in nursing and in healthcare for many years, and what I noticed was a disconnect between the treatment in the office that the patients received and their life outside of the office. And what I mean is, for instance, I worked with some pain management doctors with an anesthesiology background. Patients would come in, they would get epidural injections or facet injections, and that would help their pain then. Or they were given oral medications that would help their pain then. But when they went home, that pain would persist, and that chronic pain led to depression. That depression would lead to the use of antidepressants. And then often on top of that, self-medication with alcohol. And I saw many patients who I knew as friends outside of the hospital whose marriages had been strained to the point of breaking, whose personal and working relationships had been taxed. And it's because as you were saying earlier, pain is invisible. These people are in constant pain, but they can't get relief from the treatments that they're being given. And because they can't, they turn to anything they can.
Well,
because there's an old expression, pain is inevitable, misery is optional, and they don't want to be miserable.
Let me ask first, Paul, I'd like to hear you react to the physiology of this, that, you know, your interventions work in the office and then they go home.
Well, one of the ways that I try to avoid what the caller has described is by having patients follow up routinely. So there may be some practitioners who perform injections primarily, and that's it. And then patients go home and then return a couple months later for another injection. What I think is more helpful, really, is to, yes, perform perhaps an injection if it's indicated, and then have patients return maybe a month later, maybe a couple of weeks later, to report the impact and the outcome of that injection.
So stay in touch.
Stay in touch, stay connected.
Would help that problem. I want to turn to you, Sarah, in just a minute that we have left. We've been talking about relationships throughout the show and how pain negatively affects it. Can relationships help heal pain also?
Yes, if families can come together and face this crisis together, the best thing families can do is to believe the patient in pain, that they truly are in pain. They're not just trying to get out of doing the dishes or going to work, and help the patient identify what is helpful. Are you doing the relaxation? Are you doing the meditation?
Without nagging.
Right. Just suggest without sort of saying, you know, this is what I think you should do. The other thing I think is realizing that pain disorders affect the family too, and the family needs support
right.
to deal with this, not just the patient.
And if the family is helping the patient feel better, then the patient has to do what they can to help the family with
mm-hmm.
their coping skills
mm-hmm.
too. That usually helps everybody if you feel like you're contributing. I want to thank you both so much for joining us today. I think it was helpful and informative.
You're welcome.
My guests have been Drs. Sarah Whitman and Paul Christo. Whitman's a clinical assistant professor at Drexel University. She's got a private practice, and her website is howtocopewithpain.org. Christo's the multidisciplinary pain fellowship director for the Pain Treatment Center at Hopkins. Check out the Pain Treatment Center. It's at hopkinsmedicine.org/pain. And also check out the National Pain Foundation. It's a great website. That's nationalpainfoundation.org. Well, WHYY's Children's Service kicks off its fifth year of In the Spirit of Family series on Thursday, November 29th from 6 to 8. The topic is Universal Language of Grief. For more information, contact us at whyy.org. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Bob Purdick. Gita Simons helped win the production of today's show. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Mike and Scott produces Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Have a good week, my friends.
Day-to-day is...